North America has a love affair with the car. There are car clubs, car shows, car websites, car movies, even car songs. One man posted a note to our website a while back. It said, "Hands off my car." In this part of the world, car is king. But the vehicles we drive in, the trains we ride on, the planes we fly in, make up about a third of North America's CO2 emissions. And so a question, can we keep moving, but in a way that is healthier for our planet? Tonight, planes, trains, and automobiles. It's part two of our special series on energy, live from the Equinox Summit in Waterloo, Ontario.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
Here we are again, night two at the beautiful Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, one of Canada's leading research institutions, and the host this week, along with the University of Waterloo, of the Equinox Summit. Yes, it's all happening here. Scientists, policy experts, industry reps, they've gathered to come up with a blueprint for a low-carbon, electrified future by the year 2030. They've been at it for a few days now in a series of forums that we are streaming live online at tvo.org/theagenda. And hi again, everybody. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for joining us again tonight in Waterloo, where the agenda will be considering our energy future right through to the end of the week. Some housekeeping issues before we get started. We are streaming this broadcast live on our homepage. That's tvo.org/theagenda. Our own Mike Miner is hosting a live chat on our homepage, tvo.org/theagenda. So dial up and get your views out there on the record. Joining him tonight, some of the conference's youth delegates, all experts as well, who can answer your questions about energy. We're also on our Facebook page, so you can weigh in there as well. That's facebook.com/theagenda. Or you can send us a tweet. That's at twitter.com. And the hashtags are YourAgenda or Equinox Summit. So again, log on, let us know what you think. Okay, transportation. For years we have relied on cheap oil to fill up our gas tanks, to keep us mobile, and to raise our standard of living. But that era may be coming to an end. And here to help us imagine what might come next, how about this team? David Keith, Canada Research Chair in Energy and the Environment. He's from the University of Calgary. Greg Natterer, Canada Research Chair in Advanced Energy Systems. He's at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology. Maria Skylas-Kazakos, Professor Emeritus in the School of Chemical Sciences and Engineering, University of New South Wales, Australia. Aaron Leopold, Director of Environment and Sustainable Development at the Global Governance Institute in Brussels, Belgium. And the guy we like to call the hometown talent, Jeff Casello, Professor of Transportation, University of Waterloo. It's great to have you all here with us tonight on TVO. Look forward to hearing your comments through the course of our hour this evening. And we want to start just by setting the table with one of the many quite wonderful videos, actually, that have been produced for this conference. This one's all about the trouble with carbon. And Michael Smith, if you would, roll the tape.
CO2 in the atmosphere is measured in parts per million. But what does that mean when we can't actually see it? Imagine the carbon dioxide gas as a solid. Think of soot. Each year, we're emitting 8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide. If that were soot, we could fill up about 1 million rail cars. Since the Industrial Revolution, we could have filled 430 million rail cars, enough to circle the Earth 190 times. Today, the CO2 in the atmosphere is like a thick blanket around the Earth. And as the blanket grows heavier, the planet gets sicker. 350 parts per million is the accepted carbon blanket in the atmosphere that would keep the planet livable for the human race. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, we were at 289 parts per million. By 2011, it grew to around 392 parts per million. In 2030, some predict we will exceed 450 parts per million.
Incidentally, all of those explanatory, quite wonderful explanatory online presentations are available, all those videos on our webpage, tvo.org/theagenda. Have a look and see at some of the background that will help you understand some of the issues we're going to be talking about tonight. So, keeping the CO2 emissions down is the big challenge. First, before we get our group here into the discussion, a few more facts for your consideration. Planes, trains, and automobiles. What do we do? Well, worldwide, all forms of transportation represent about 27% of all energy use in the number in the United States, a little higher than that. In Canada, a little higher still at 30%. There are, if you can imagine, 750 million cars on the road today worldwide. They use up about 60% of all oil produced in the year 2010, and it's estimated that by the year 2050, there will be 1.6 billion cars on the road. So if you could figure out a way to get those cars off oil, off the internal combustion engine, and onto something else, say batteries, electric power, who knows, imagine how we could clean up the environment. And I want to start, Michael, if you would, let's go to a wide shot of the hall here. Everybody thinks electric cars are a recent invention. And I want to hear from this audience here. Shout it out if you have a guess on the year. What year were the first electric cars on our roads? And in fact, at that time, they constituted the majority of the cars we drove at the time. Throw it a year. Just shout it out. 1912 is not bad. It's earlier. 1911 is not bad. It's earlier. You got to keep going back, folks. Turn of the century. 1899. That's right. We heard it right here. 1899, the majority of the cars on our roads were electric cars. And then Henry Ford came up with something called the Model T and changed history, and that's the way it went. Okay, so Greg, get us started here. The electric car technology, is it ready to avenge its past defeats?
I think the short answer is yes. There are, as we know now, Chevy Volt and a number of other automotive manufacturers have electric vehicles that have been coming out and are on the market now. So I do think that they do have a very promising future. One has to, in terms of comparing and looking at the CO2 emissions that we heard about just a few minutes ago, we do need to keep in mind one thing, though, and that maybe is not generally well known, that approximately 85% of the electricity in the world is still coming from fossil fuels. So when you trace the electricity needed to run those electric vehicles going back to the origin, we're still at a point where we need to look that there is still the CO2 emissions coming from the source. But anyway,
let's just make sure we understand that. So you're saying if we manage to get cars off gas and plug them into the AC adapter, for lack of a better expression, in order to electrify them or run them on battery, if that power is still created by coal-fired generating stations, we're no further ahead.
I think we are slightly ahead because we can control the emissions from the source, and that's a little bit easier than trying to control the emissions, you know, and do the technologies on the individual vehicles. But the point I was trying to make is that it's a step towards the solution, and it's not really the ultimate solution that we're all hoping to eliminate the CO2 emissions. But anyway, putting that part aside, I think that we do have promising solutions that will address the issue of reducing the CO2 emissions from the electricity generation source. The electric vehicle itself is very promising. It's coming out now over the next few years. There are vehicles on the markets that consumers can purchase.
Okay, let me follow up with Maria, though, on this aspect of the story, which is, if 99%, regardless of the progress that our friend here thinks is being made, if 99% of the cars on the road today are internal combustion engines, or cars, trucks, SUVs, the whole nine yards, is it wisest to focus our efforts on improving that rather than coming up with some whole new technology?
Well, I think both things have been happening. And I think over the last 10, 20 years, we've seen an enormous improvement in the efficiency of the internal combustion engine, and cars are going a lot further for the same number of gallons of petrol, and the efficiency and the emissions have been improved. But we are going to run out of oil. And I don't think that's even a question. And also, not only that, urban pollution is still an issue in many countries and in many major cities, and that's what I think Greg was saying, that urban emission from cars is a major health issue, and if we can at least shift that to the power station, then we can clean up a lot of cities, which are very extremely dirty with pollution now. But we need to go beyond that, because if we really want to save carbon dioxide as well, we need to be able to charge those. If we're going to go to electric cars, mm-hmm. we need to be able to charge them with clean and renewable energy, which eliminates the carbon dioxide.
Aaron, where are you on this, whether we should improve the current technology or abandon it and try something else?
Well, I think you can't get around improving the technology. I think that kind of comes with the demand, which is definitely there. Currently, about 10% of cars being sold are either hybrid or they will be electric vehicles. There are 106 different models amongst the major auto manufacturers and the niche manufacturers of hybrid or fully electrified vehicles, and or in development as well as being sold now. So it's not just an issue of do we need to improve it. We have to, because the demand is definitely there, and governments are behind it. But one of the interesting things, as a policy guy, I look to governments quite a lot. They're sending some of the right signals, but also some of the wrong signals. There's been a lot of support recently, but a lot of it's been tied to the kind of recovery packages associated with the financial crisis, mm-hmm. which are often, I think in the vast majority of cases, they're set to expire 2012, 2013. So this kind of security that these companies are really looking for in terms of market is there, but not permanent.
But we'll see. Yeah. David, what's your position on this?
Well, I'd like to start with the problem more than the technical solution. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a problem of CO2 emissions, and if that's your problem, it's pretty clear you don't start worrying about cars. You start worrying about coal-fired power. It's much more cost-effective to cut emissions there. So if you were sort of objectively saying, my number one thing is climate, you both don't wake up thinking about cars.
But we're talking about transportation
Understood.
Tonight. Mm-hmm.
If you think about air pollution, you think about cars in some places, but also other freight modes, heavy freight mm-hmm. modes. But you also don't start with cars. So I guess I'd say that electric vehicles are amazingly exciting, but there are some basic physical limits. The energy density, the amount of energy you get in a battery compared to the amount you get in fuels, there are sort of factors of 10 there that are hard to imagine bridging, and cars are only half of the transportation system, roughly. So I think electric vehicles are one of the ways it might happen. I think they'll certainly happen in some places, but they're not necessarily the way it all happens. There are other competitors that are serious.
Jeff, are electric vehicles ready to reclaim their position?
Well, I think you have to think about electric vehicles, but you have to think about them as part of the holistic transportation system. So the vehicle is one component, but the infrastructure is certainly another component. And if you're talking about designing and developing for cars, what we've done in North America for the last 5 decades is basically we have designed for cars and precluded every other mode. So walking and transit and cycling, the absolute zero carbon emission modes, and walking and cycling at least, have been precluded in most of our cities. And so now we're trying to retrofit so many of our cities. I think electric vehicle technology is a step in the right direction. It will certainly reduce carbon dioxide emissions in the core of cities where many people live. So the exposure to some ground level pollutants and so on will be better with electric cars. But I think it's only a small part of the overall transportation problem that we're facing in cities.
Let me do a follow-up. What do you mean walking and cycling have been precluded as solutions? We have bike lanes all over the place in Toronto.
Yeah, well, downtown Toronto is one example, but let's go to Mississauga or let's go to other cities. And I'm always picking on Mississauga in my classes, so I hope Hazel's not watching. I'll get a nasty message. But there are many, many urban areas that have built wide arterials where the speeds are very high, where crosswalks are unsafe, where cycling next to the vehicle traffic feels very uncomfortable. And that's what I mean by precluding. So only the 0.1%, only the most ardent cyclists feel comfortable in many cities in North America, Toronto being a very positive exception to the rule.
Okay. At various times throughout the course of the program tonight, we're going to share some, I guess, fact files with you. And Michael Smith, our director, I'm going to ask you to bring up the next one this evening, and that is called Bright Lights, and it's about London, UK. In London, the electric vehicle this is the electric vehicle capital of Europe. It has 400 charging stations and an outfit called Source London. It's a public-private partnership. They've got a plan to install electric charging stations no more than a couple of kilometers away from every Londoner. And the goal is to have 1,300 chargers in place by the year 2013 in the event these battery-powered or electrified cars get going. Now, Aaron, is this adequate incentive, do you think, to get drivers to make the switch?
Well, it's a really interesting program, not only because of the incentive to switch, but also why they instituted it. You know, the major cause of air pollution in cities is transportation, and one of the major drives behind that is to get this pollution down. And in order to switch in cities, you have to have the infrastructure from outside of cities, because or in the exterior or outside of cities, I'm sorry. So the issue is that people are driving into the city. They're not driving around in the city in circles. Mm-hmm. You have to have places for them to go outside. So as long as it's being bridged with larger networks in throughout the nation, then of course it's fine. But I'm not so familiar with the system.
Greg, what do you think? Is this an option?
I think it's a very promising program. It's a step in the right direction. I think it sends a signal that there is some, there needs to be some government policy support and regulations to get the whole thing moving, because at the beginning we do need the charging stations, we need this infrastructure, and it's a little bit of a chicken and egg situation with the automakers, that you know they need the infrastructure before they put the vehicles on the road, and likewise, you know, governments and municipalities and provinces in Canada, they need to have the vehicles before they're going to put the infrastructure in place. So to have that initiative coming from the government, in this case the example that you gave, it's absolutely a positive step in the right direction.
Maria, it's always a chicken and egg thing, isn't it? We're not going to buy these battery cars unless we've got infrastructure to hook them up to. We're not going to hook up the infrastructure until there's enough cars on the road.
Well, exactly. And not only that, it's also cost as well. And in some parts of the world, the cost of electric cars is actually quite prohibitive, and people just won't go that way. So it is a chicken and egg. But I think that that governments can do a lot of other things to try and encourage people, even at a higher cost, to buy electric cars. They could, for example, give free parking in the city, which is, you know, something which is a premium thing for people to be able to park in the city, especially if you plug in at a recharging station. They could, for example, allow people to use transit lanes. So all of these things could be used to encourage, even at a high cost, for people to get into the electric vehicle market.
David?
The chicken and egg reality of vehicles, that vehicles and fuel stick together in a way that's very hard to separate. Remember, as you brought at the beginning, we had battery vehicles, we had biofuel vehicles, we had a whole range of vehicles 100 years ago, and we ended up with one choice. And so it's going to be very hard to have a diversity of choices again. And I think that means we should be careful about assuming we know what the answer is. Mm-hmm. It's very different. It's more to think how different it is from electricity. For electricity, it's much easier to say you're going to do some wind power and some nuclear power and kind of mix and match. You don't have to make a single choice. But for vehicles, it's much harder. And what I think that says is we need policy experiments. We shouldn't assume we know the answer is electric vehicles. It will be in some places, but how it really plays out depends on lots of things that are unguessable at this point.
So get dozens of solutions.
We need
out
a bunch
there.
Of solutions out there where we really test them without deciding by government fiat what the answer is now.
Aaron, at the risk of having this audience think up their own dozen different punchlines to the name I'm about to throw out there, but Governor Schwarzenegger of California did promise at the beginning of his tenure to put charging stations all over California, said he was going to lead the world.
Yeah.
Okay, X number of years later, where are they on that?
They have a few dozen tops in major metropolitan areas, and one of the issues is that it has to do with the chicken and the egg. You know, they said they'll have the charging stations, but that didn't necessarily mean that the consumers were convinced that, well, it was the right time to buy. Electricity is still expensive, especially in California. And there was, in the middle of this, you know, because Schwarzenegger was in power for quite a long time, a lot of world events happened. The financial crisis came at the end and whatnot. He also had another initiative with solar panels on roofs in the cities that didn't really go as planned. So, you know, with renewable energy policies and with efficiency policies and whatnot, I have to agree that, you know, you have to try a gamut of different policy options. There is no silver bullet.
Let me try this with you, Jeff. This is a story from China. When we talk about how much intervention from government we need, here's what the Chinese are doing. Here's the story. Young woman buys an electric car in China. The government pays 45% of the sticker price. The local electricity authority in the city where she lives offers the first 500 buyers of these cars the chance to have a charging facility installed near their homes for free. Question, will our governments have to intervene in the marketplace as dramatically to encourage a shift away from conventional cars?
Well, we already are intervening a little bit in the marketplace. If I go out and buy a very fuel-efficient vehicle in North America, I may get a rebate from my government for buying a very fuel-efficient hybrid car. If I go out and buy an H3, which I don't drive, if I go out and buy that car, I get a gas guzzler penalty. So we're already starting to do some economic incentives to encourage people to behave but in a certain way. But I think the problem is, Steve, if you look at our fuel prices in North America, they remain half of what they are in the rest of the world.
So, and yet people are screaming about paying 80 to 90 to 100 bucks to fill up their tank.
And as a function of your income, they've never been less than they are today. Well, maybe that's a little bit different in the last few months, but up until a year ago, it was cheaper than it ever was before in North America because we are earning more. Our earnings have grown faster than our fuel prices. So when you look at the UK example and you wonder why in London there's so much motivation to introduce these plug-in stations, if you were paying £1 or $2.10 Canadian per liter of gas, you would think very differently about your travel choices. And so some economic push from the government, something to change the way we think about our transportation behavior now, is incredibly important.
We actually heard this last night from Václav Smil as well, from the University of Manitoba, who said unless you treble or quadruple the price of gas, it's not going to change people's behavior at all.
Yeah. And again, we've got to drive on what the problem is. So if air pollution is the problem, there are certain things you want to do, and it's not just cars. Don't forget the heavy vehicles that are a lot of the killer in terms of air pollution. Mm-hmm. If it's climate, it's something else. So don't, you know, policies that choose the answer narrowly are going to repeat the hydrogen experience.
Maria, let me try this with you. We've talked about battery-operated cars and electric cars. How about salvation through hydrogen? How do you regard the importance to this solution of the hydrogen fuel cell in vehicles?
I'm a little bit of a skeptic when it comes to hydrogen fuel cells, I've got to say. But for many years, especially 10 years ago, people were putting billions of dollars into electrolyzing water. I mean, and the whole concept of the hydrogen economy. We've got plenty of water, we just use the sun's energy, we electrolyze it, produce hydrogen, run it, put it into a fuel cell. But to get there, people didn't realize that, you know, the efficiency of that process is extremely low.
You need to use a lot of energy to make that
happen. You need an enormous amount of energy for every liter of hydrogen or whatever you produce. So that wasn't really the best approach. But we are looking now at alternative ways of generating hydrogen, and Greg has explained a few of those during the summit to us. And I'm starting to get convinced that there are potential uses for hydrogen, but I wouldn't say not for quite a while in fuel cells. Because we could burn hydrogen. There's no reason why we can't burn hydrogen as in a combustion engine. So, and I think there will be a niche for hydrogen in long haul vehicles, for example, where batteries won't be able to get us far enough. And in fact, there has to be a mix of different technologies for all the different needs that we'll have in the society.
But you know what people love about them? You know what comes out of the exhust pipe? Mm-hmm.
Water.
You can drink it.
Yeah, of course.
It's beautiful. Okay, Greg, you want to give us the other side of the story on hydrogen fuel cells?
Well, yes, I have an optimistic view on hydrogen. I think it's not a matter of if, but when. So, I mean, if we look at countries around the world on the initiatives that they've done, that they're moving forward very, very aggressively on hydrogen. Mm-hmm. Germany, for example, recently has invested $2 billion in 1,000 hydrogen refueling stations across the country. Kia, which is a South Korean automaker, has recently committed to 10,000 vehicle production of hydrogen vehicles by 2015. And so I have a positive view of hydrogen going forward. It's not to say that there aren't challenges. There definitely are challenges because, like electric vehicles, hydrogen still is relying primarily on fossil fuels as the source of hydrogen. But if you look at the principle at stake, you know, with regards to electric vehicles and hydrogen vehicles, is the principle of a chemical fuel. And I think chemical fuel is here to stay, and hydrogen is a chemical fuel. It has a very high energy density, higher than what electric batteries can provide. Both the electric vehicles and the hydrogen have their challenges. For example, we didn't touch on it earlier, but you know, with electric vehicles, some of the challenges include the limited range of distance that one can travel, the relatively long time that you need to charge the vehicles.
But we assume all that's going to get resolved in the next few years, right?
There's a lot of research on it, but there are also some limits of engineering and thermodynamics as far as we can go. And my point being is that hydrogen is a chemical fuel that I think has unique advantages over electric, but in the end, it remains to be seen. It's not necessarily a competition between the two. They may be complementary. We may see electric vehicles with hydrogen as a range extension fuel to provide the longer range. So, but I do have an optimistic view on hydrogen going forward.
David?
I mean, it's a wonderful thing people talk about cars because it's the part of the energy economy every human really sees, or every rich human. And so it's natural to think about it, but it really is important not to forget the other parts of the transportation system. So a while ago, some friends and I thought about back in the hydrogen days when we were partly trying to deflate the hydrogen bubble a little bit. We said to ourselves, if we had hydrogen and we wanted to put it in transportation, where would be the most environmentally and cost-effective place to put it? What we found was heavy freight and big vehicles, because those things have, in some cases, pollution that is order of 100 times worse per unit of fuel than cars, because we've regulated cars very effectively. So you get enormously better air pollution bang for your buck, it turns out. And the refueling infrastructure that you need is much simpler. So let us not forget the rest, the other 50% of the transportation infrastructure that isn't cars.
Absolutely, fair point. But Jeff, obviously, there are sections of the newspaper devoted to the thing we love the most. You know, everybody writes about the cars that we love to drive. And I guess the question is, do you see a future where the amount of reliance we have today on everybody, I mean, you see this on the 400 series highways of this province, 90% of the cars on the road are one driver per car. Do you see any way around that future?
There's a really easy answer to that question. The audience and the viewers at home may not like it, but when the toll booths come up on the 401 and we begin to charge you a reasonable price to bring your car by yourself onto that freeway, we actually charge you what it costs to maintain that. No one's coming down, right? Okay, Jeff, we're safe so far.
It's an election year, Jeff. Yeah. It ain't going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
But I think that if you look around the world, Steve, the rest of the world is beginning to price transportation in a different way. And, you know, I think the car, whether it's an electric car, whether it's a hydrogen fuel car, it's always going to have a role in the North American community. The question is, do we want to build our communities where it's 97% of the trips, or do we want to build our communities so it's 80% of the trips? I mean, do you want to solve our emissions problems? The average occupancy for a car in North America is about 1.15 persons. If we doubled that to 2.3, we would cut our emissions in half immediately. So the problem can be a technological one, but it can also be a very much a behavioral one.
Cultural in some respects.
Yeah. I'd also like just to add that although we're talking about hydrogen and high tech and whatnot in this summit, we also have to consider that most of the world would not in the near future be able to adopt such advanced technologies for their mobility needs. And even when you're talking about personal mobility needs, we need to consider the options that are going to be global in scope. And so hydrogen is maybe an option for heavy freight in North America or maybe also overseas, but most of the developing world would not be able to deal with something like this or create the infrastructure for something like
Aaron,
that in the
future.
Aaron,
you lead me nicely to our next graphic. Perfect. Did you know I was going to do this next? It's a lovely segue. We talked England earlier. Let's talk about Brazil. Yeah. You want to talk about the developing world? Here we go. Michael Smith, next graphic, if you would. Brazil, where sugarcane is replacing oil as a fuel source for cars. Apparently, more than 50% of the cars in Brazil have what's called flex fuel engines, which allow them to run on either gasoline or ethanol. It's expected that by the year 2017, 90% of all the cars in Brazil will have flex fuel engines. Now, you have the floor here, Aaron, there's a lot of debate about this. Some people think this is a great idea. Other people see it as contributing to food prices going through the roof. Where are you?
There's a lot of debate on this, and there's technical debates, and there's political and social debates. And on the technical side, it's really interesting that you see the, especially the American and Canadian drivers really up in arms about what ethanol-based fuel will do to their pipes and their sprockets and whatnot in their engines. But the fact is that this technology, this flex fuel technology, has been around in Brazil since 2003, and it is amazing. They can drive with any mixer from 0 to 100% ethanol. There's a little tiny, very simple computer that does the mathematics, and it's not a problem. So really, the automobile lobby and these kind of economic interests that are really hesitant to change things have had a large influence on the debate in North America, which is largely unnecessary in my opinion. But on the social side, you do have really important issues to worry about. For example, Brazil is normally an exporter of ethanol to the United States, for example, which has been using corn ethanol to fuel a large part of its, or I should say a large amount of its fleet in recent years. Now, in 2006 and resurging now as food prices begin to rise again, there were food versus fuel concerns. Where was that going? Well, the interesting thing is now that the tables have been turned and the United States actually exported billions of liters of corn-based ethanol to Brazil because of a bad harvest last year. So what happens when there's a bad harvest in the United States, and there's high demand for fuel. So you have this kind of tension. Well, where is it really going to go? And that is a real question that has not really been resolved in the political spheres.
David, for those who say it's obscene to be putting something you could grow and eat when there's this much famine in the world to make a car go, what do you say to them?
I don't have a simple answer. I mean, famines are fundamentally political in many ways.
Yes.
It's not like we don't have enough calories to go around on this planet by any means. But I think it is also true that if we tried to supply any significant fraction of human energy needs on biofuels, on growing things and turning them into whether it's ethanol or other hydrocarbons, I think that you really start to have a big footprint on nature. Mm-hmm. And you could conceivably manage it, but it's not clear to me that that is worth the effort.
Maria, let me ask you about China. They're anticipating 200 million cars on the roads of China by the year 2020. You already can't breathe the air there in big cities on most days.
That's for sure.
They're a very resourceful country, though. Are they going to solve this problem?
Well, the interesting thing about China is that they've gone from a situation where so many people were riding bicycles around to now really jamming their highways with cars. And I think the traffic is just is becoming unbearable. Other parts of the world are going away. Now they're going to car, to bicycles. I think at some stage in the future, I think the two have to come together, and perhaps we'll see in China, especially now that they've got electric bicycles, I think that will actually start putting people back onto the bicycles and off the roads, less traffic, less congestion, much cleaner as well. So I think that's the other, especially for short distance driving, electric bicycles I think have got a big future.
It's a big deal. People often understate this, that the Chinese have made this enormous sort of bottom-up push for electric bicycles. Even in rural places now, you can buy them cheaply. You see them everywhere, not just in the big cities. It's the single biggest build-out that I know about of electric vehicles, and it's happening in the real world in China.
Electric bicycles?
Yes, electric scooters.
Electric bicycles.
Yeah.
Just bicycles.
But if you look at the rate of auto ownership, I mean, they are the Chinese, India, they are still well behind North America in terms of their auto ownership per capita, but the rate of growth is astronomical relative to North America. So their rate of growth of owning cars is growing much, much faster than it is here in North America.
The other piece I was going to add is that for China, I think the public transportation system, the mass transit, they've got really state-of-the-art trains that they're putting. I mean, this is another piece of the puzzle that can have an impact on reducing their environmental footprint.
I just wonder, Michael Smith, I wonder if we can get a wide shot of this audience. Let me see a show of hands here in the room. Do you know that Google, which already owns and controls everything, is working on a prototype of a driverless car? You know this. Hands up. Let's see. Oh, this is a very smart audience. Okay. This is a car with no driver. You program where you want to go. It knows to stop at a stoplight. It knows to turn right. It knows not to hit the guy in front of him. This is amazing. Aaron, how could this potentially revolutionize what happens on our roads?
Well, of course, for safety issues, I recently saw a lecture about this. It's got huge implications, but the issue in terms of energy usage, I don't think is that major, but it will kind of even out the acceleration, deceleration issues that we have with kind of drivers who love their fast cars and speed and whatnot.
I'm just imagining fewer accidents, less work for the auto body shop, so that's maybe a downside for them, but the insurance business, I mean, it just could turn everything on its ear, David.
I think people are vastly undercounting the role of intelligent vehicles in changing the transportation system pretty fundamentally. And here's one of the ways, I'm not an expert, but you can imagine real change. So right now, public transportation all goes pretty much by fixed routes. It's not dispatched. You have a big bus moving on fixed routes, it's either full or it's not, there's no flexibility. So let's say you have buses that are maybe a third the size, and let's say that in people's houses, they say, I want to go to place A or place B, and you have dynamic scheduling. We now have, for the first time, the computing power to do that kind of dynamic scheduling. So there's not a fixed schedule, the bus says, oh, I'll be there in 4.7 minutes, or it can be shorter if you pay me an extra buck. And then the bus dynamically schedules where it's going. It's now possible to imagine doing that, and that would dramatically reduce the energy per passenger mile because you get benefits.
The system is in place in many places, particularly in rural and lower density areas where the 40-foot bus doesn't make sense to drive around.
Exactly.
One of the issues in North America about the on-demand transit service is that 70% of our operating cost is from labor. So it doesn't matter if there's one driver driving a 40-foot bus or an 8-person
bus.
Right,
but if there's no drivers driving a bus.
Well, that's an enormous infrastructure challenge, I think, to have that in place.
I think it gets to be a less infrastructure challenge every year. And if we're looking ahead 2030 or so, the idea that at that point you actually get to be safer with no driver in the bus is very
plausible.
One
thing I know for sure, if we get this driverless car on the road, people are going to be demanding the Ontario government repeal its no texting laws. That's for sure. We got to be allowed to do that.
What about drinking and driving?
Let's just, we're about the midway point, so let's, it's about time to check in with Mike Miner. Before we do that though, Michael, can I throw you a bit of a curveball here and show the screen? Those of you in the audience here have no doubt been looking not only at what our guests have to say, but also at the big screen above me here, because from time to time, if you have been getting online and joining our online conversation or following us on Facebook or through Twitter, your comments have been going up on the screen throughout the course of the evening, but again, up on the big board right there. And those of you who are at home and wondering if we're following along with some of the things you've been saying all night, yes, we have been. And for more on that, here's our fifth column blogger, Mike Miner. Take it away, Mike.
Hi, Steve. A lot of conversation going on online. It's been happening all day. You were just talking about the intelligent car. Tundi from Timmins points out that this is just going to ruin NASCAR. People are talking about, in the urban setting, people are talking about what it would take to get them out of their cars. And everyone on this chat is certainly willing to move on. What they're looking for is a great public transportation system. Deborah says that subways and trains like they have in London, England would be enough to get her out of her car. MW, who's from Essex County, says that she would have to move closer to an urban setting. And she thinks when she visits, the ability to walk around might be appealing for that, but she doesn't see how she can do it in her hometown. We also had C Musician, and he tweeted in from Kenora. And Kenora, of course, is in the northwest of the province. And getting around the city is not so bad. He says they have a fairly decent in-town bus service, but there's no rail service or bus service to get around to other cities. You can't get to Winnipeg, you can't get to Thunder Bay. So these types of questions about the moving around the province and moving around on a larger scale are keeping a lot of people in their cars, and it's a big concern, and they really have a lot of questions for our provincial government about it. William says he needs his vehicle for work, and he thinks that if you don't need a vehicle for work, you're lucky, but for him, he's going to be using a car pretty much as long as he has this career. What you're hearing on the chat is that a lot of people seem to think that invention, new energy sources, or a scarcity of oil, something like that, will take care of the problem for them. Nobody on the chat, however, says that they love their car too much to give it up. They'd be willing to make a change, but personal initiative doesn't really seem to be the thing that's going to drive it.
Huh. Okay, Mike, thanks very much for that. A reminder, tvo.org/theagenda or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/theagenda, or send us a tweet, #YourAgenda, #EquinoxSummit. Both of those get to us as well. We'll put your comments up on the screen throughout the course of the broadcast. And a reminder, we are, of course, here all week long at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, affiliated with the University of Waterloo, their program here, the Equinox Summit. We are considering the energy future of the world to the year 2030. And they've got experts from all over the world who have gathered here for the week. We're streaming live their conversations at tvo.org/theagenda throughout the daytime. We're here every night live at 8 p.m. to do a program on some aspect of looking ahead for the next 20 years on our energy future. And tonight we're talking transportation. And to that end, let us consider flight of a different kind. Michael, let's roll this tape here. This plane recently landed in Brussels. Aaron, you must know this. After a successful flight from Zurich, and why we're showing this to you is that it is the first solar-powered plane to have undertaken such a long flight. So far, as you can see, it carries one person. But if they were ever, David, to figure out how to do this for 6 or 20 or 300 people, solar-powered flight, what might that look like?
I'm excited about solar power, and I think these activities do an enormous job of improving aircraft engineering, but I don't expect that in the long run we're going to move people around in solar-powered airplanes in big numbers. Because there's just not the energy density issue. You just don't get enough solar power on the size of an airplane to move it at a meaningful speed. Mm-hmm. It's important, first of all, to say the enormous progress we made on regular airplanes. So a 727 was like 30 seat miles to gallon round numbers, a little worse than that. 787 is like 100. And we can still do better than that quite easily. And I think in the long run, we can do solar-powered planes easily, But what that means is a solar-powered system that makes fuels on the ground, and then you put the fuels in the airplane.
Okay, if solar power doesn't work to move 300, 350 people around, there's one. Can't be that much more to get to four. Already you're talking kind of executive jet use, right? And there's lots of that in there.
Yeah, but it intrinsically goes very slow. I don't think you're going to sell a lot of executives on something that cruises at probably 40 knots. That's the wrong number. But,
okay.
But no, I think there's some intrinsic reasons why basically aircraft are very efficient when they fly relatively high, where there's not much air, and they fly fast. And I just don't think that's compatible with the power densities you get from solar.
Okay.
But again, we can make solar vehicles, solar airplane. We just got to use the sun to make fuel. There are lots of ways you can do that. Then you put the fuel in the airplane.
It just, we learned last night that the amount of energy created by the sun is so fantastic. Mm. And if there were a way to harness that in an effective and relatively inexpensive way, you'd never need to build another coal-fired generating station. You'd never need to drill for another bucket of oil. Mm. That'd be it, right? Wouldn't that be it, Maria?
Well, definitely. But the problem is cost. Until we get the cost right, then people are not going to be choosing solar. So while we've got very cheap electricity from coal or from natural gas, then it's so hard for all renewable energies to compete. Now, we've already seen that there's been a big progress with wind turbines. So they've managed to get the cost down to a reasonable level. But even so, some people would say it's still too expensive. But again, it depends on what part of the world you're from. And from where I come from, electricity is actually quite expensive, so renewable energy is actually starting to become quite attractive. But in North America, I think it's going to be a while before that happens.
Well, let's talk about what if you're from one of the biggest cities in the world. And to that end, the United Nations has done a study, and they said that a couple of years ago there were 21 megacities in the world, and they define that as populations exceeding 10 million. So I don't think you've got one in Australia. I don't think
we're 4 million in Sydney, so
okay, but that's not 10.
No.
And we haven't
gotten
any in Canada.
But it's bad enough. It's getting bad enough.
It's not bad. By the year 2025, the United Nations estimates there will be 29, up from 21, 29 so-called megacities, and that they will hold one-tenth of the world's population in just those 29 locations. Let's consider, Jeff, let me get you on this first. How will that increasing urbanization change or affect the way we travel?
Well, the question really becomes, what model do we follow? One of the questions that we see in China and India again is that a lot of the development patterns are starting to mirror what North America did in the 1950s, and Europe to a much lesser extent. But if we see these cities developing where there's the decentralization that happened in North America and again in Western Europe a little bit, if we start to see cities spread out and long transportation distances, and we start to rely only on motorized power, whether it's again hydrogen, electric, it doesn't matter, biofuels, if that's the case, then one-tenth of the world's population is going to rely on mechanical power to travel. And we can do that if we build certain high capacity, high energy efficient modes to connect these longer distances, okay. But if we're all going to have our own power source and our own mechanical vehicle and our own protected area in which we drive, then we're going to have the same sort of problems.
Greg, how does it look to you?
Yeah, I think I fully agree with the previous point being that we're going to need to look at a higher density of population rather than, you know, the suburbs getting further and further out, communities becoming less and less sustainable, especially when gas prices are going up. So that's one part of it. I agree that we need to look at density, increasing the density in the cities. The second part of it is the air pollution issue. When you mentioned the statistics to me, that's the first thing that came to mind is, air pollution, it leads to illness, it leads to disease, healthcare costs are going to be going up. So we really need to tackle the issue of air pollution. And the way it is that we talked about earlier, it's the electric vehicle, it's hydrogen, not only for the personal vehicles, but also, you know, trains. There's alternative technologies there. Rather than diesel, we can be looking at electrification and hydrogen again, which I'm positive on that as a solution for the trains in the large cities.
Maria, one of the criticisms that I got from a few emailers over the past couple of days was that not only were these people critical of the fact that we weren't on this program discussing the possibilities around conservation enough, but that you in your work throughout the week here aren't either. We're looking at every newfangled possible bit of technology, but not using less. Is using less an option we ought to be thinking about more?
Well, in fact, that was raised in this afternoon's one of our afternoon workshops, that we'd really need to start looking at energy efficiency, conservation, and hopefully we'll have time to discuss all of these things in the next couple of days. But certainly there's a huge, an enormous amount of scope where we could actually save quite a lot of resources by using less of it. But getting back to public, and so public transport is, I think, is an important way that we can achieve a lot of savings in fuel. But unless we've got cheap public transport, and that doesn't happen everywhere, like for example in our city, someone said yesterday that in some parts of maybe Canada and America, that a lot of people are embarrassed to take the train because they think, you've got to be economically challenged, to be able to take a public transport. Where I come from, you've got to be rich.
It's
expensive. It's extremely expensive. So if you've got two people driving to work in a similar destination, it's cheaper to take your car. So really, governments have got to be able to provide incentives. They've got to be able to subsidize public transport. And unless they do subsidize public transport, then we're not going to be able to see a shift from individual cars to buses. And trains.
You want to follow on that, Jeff?
Yeah, I do. I think what's happening in North America is the price of public transport isn't very high, but the quality is not competitive with the automobile. One of the things that I look at is travel models that say how much does it cost to make a trip from point A to point B, and that includes time and convenience and safety and really the stigma factor. And in some places, in Waterloo Region, for example, the ratio can be 10 times more expensive to make the same trip by transit than by auto. So which rational person is going to make that decision? Now, part of the problem is we don't invest enough in transport in our transit infrastructure. We also underprice the automobile travel. So there are certainly some corridors in every city where by getting the prices a little bit closer to right, we could make transit a lot more competitive in North America.
David, I once saw, and it's funny, I thought of this just now because it's his birthday today. Happy 82nd birthday, former Prime Minister John Turner. I saw him on the subway in Toronto one day, and I thought to myself, if the former PM is on the subway, there's obviously no stigma associated with taking the subway.
I think the social stuff is really, really important for transportation. Mm. For electricity, you can say it's just technical. So the choice of whether it's wind or nuclear, at some point, you just get power. But for transportation, the social effects are huge. I often think to myself that when I'm in North America and I'm driving, I like to bicycle, but when I'm driving, everybody else on the road is sort of my enemy. They're in the way. Mm. But when I'm in Europe and I'm traveling on public transit or in big American cities where I'm in public transit, then I think to myself, oh, we're all fellow travelers. Mm-hmm. It's a very different feeling. And I think cities that we build around public transit tend to bring people together in ways that are really important. And we have to pay attention to the reasons we're just hearing why people don't like it. But there are benefits to the investment in public infrastructure, public transit, that I think transcend the kind of narrow way you count them in terms of CO2 emissions or air pollution deaths.
You're from Brussels, right? You're living in Brussels?
I'm actually living in Germany, but I'm based in Brussels, yeah.
Based in Brussels? Well, it probably works for both countries. We're under the assumption that European capitals, big cities over there, subsidize their public transit a lot more than we do here. I know in the capital of Ontario, for example, 3/4 of the operating expenses come from the fare box. There's not that much subsidy at all. How do they do it there? Do they do it well?
Well, one of the issues in Germany where I do live is that the public rail system is in the process of being privatized, and it was highly subsidized, and they've been going through a huge public debate with rising prices, and privatization should actually create efficiency and the prices should go down, but they've been going up because they've been finding out that, well, it's not as difficult or it's not as easy as we once thought. And the challenge with that is that although the price is going up, it is extremely important, and there's a genuine social benefit, not only psychologically, but really as a society, to increase public transportation. You look at people who live in very remote areas, people with disabilities that don't have family members that can take them anywhere, access to schools, access to hospitals for disadvantaged people. This is not an issue of just, how much does it cost? This is a real social problem.
In which case, Jeff, how do I put this? Nobody grows up thinking, God, I'd love to ride that subway train. They think, geez, I'd love to buy that Mustang or that Camaro.
Exactly, yeah.
How do you make riding the tube as sexy as it is owning a sports car?
Well, Margaret Thatcher once said that anybody who rides the bus to work above the age of 25 is a failure. That's what Margaret Thatcher said. So that is...
Not helpful.
I'm a failure every morning on my way to university. But how do you make transit cool is really the question. And I'll tell you one thing that we've done very well in North America is we give almost every university student now a transit pass that is part of their tuition fees. And so everyone who is between 18 and 25 in Canada and many North American cities have come to know transit, have known its efficiency, understand that it's not the stigma that we're talking about. So, you know, where my parents have very rarely ever ridden a transit bus, my generation and then the next generation are becoming much more familiar with transit as a viable option. So some of that problem is going away. Now, we're also doing cooler things with our transit. You know, we're integrating with our smartphones. So the kinds of idea where if I want to go to work in the morning, I get up, I check my smartphone, it tells me that the next bus is leaving in 4 minutes or the next LRT vehicle is leaving in 3.5 minutes.
Is that stuff really
you know
work?
What we're doing? We're getting the information from people who are on the bus.
Oh,
so
okay.
It's absolutely accurate. We're, we're crowdsourcing. That's what we're doing, and it's a fantastic way. It's free because everybody's got GPS units in their phone, so it works brilliantly. So yeah,
okay.
It's coming cooler.
Few minutes to go here. Let's finish up with these couple of things. Greg, to you first. 100-mile diets. Airlines asking us to buy carbon offsets. We are, you know, when we use a lot of carbon nowadays, we're made to feel a little bit guilty about it. And I want to know whether you think, as you consider your work here, looking towards the year 2030, are we going to be able to fly wherever we want, whenever we want, guilt-free, as we look forward?
Okay, I think the short answer is yes. I'm optimistic about this. I do think that we'll be able to move forward with the standard of living that we have today, despite the challenges with the, you know, with the fossil fuels and so on. And I think the answer will be the technology and the research. And we've heard a lot about this week at the summit. The aviation and the alternatives to jet fuel in the future is a very interesting question. It's a challenging one. In many ways, more challenging than the automobile, because you know you can't fly an airplane a cross-Atlantic flight with a battery. You just can't do it.
Done.
You don't have that. There are alternatives though. One of them is biofuels. There's been work done in that area. The aviation and the aerospace industry is rather, one can say, conservative in the sense that it takes a long time for such a major change from a new fuel to make its way into a reality, into another an aircraft. But the one point I was going to make as well is that, again, I don't want to repeat the point again, but hydrogen is another solution here. Liquid hydrogen can be a zero emission source of aviation fuel in the future. It does take more volume than jet fuel. On the other hand, it's much lighter than
jet fuel.
Okay,
let me hear from David on this. Just a couple of minutes left here.
Yeah.
David, on this issue of guilt-free flying in the future, how does it look to you?
I don't think guilt is that effective a motivator here. Things like flying around are always going to have environmental impacts. So it's always going to be a trade-off. Overall, I think connecting people up around the world by flying has had an enormous role in making us not have big wars. So overall, I don't have any guilt about the fact that we have a transportation system that allows people to communicate. But I do think it's always going to be true that transportation is going to cause environmental damage and other kinds of damage. So it'll never be guilt-free. Mm. Can we make it a lot better? Yes.
Hmm. Maria, we found this interesting little factoid today. Our producer, Vodek Schemberg, found it. Researchers in Sweden discovered that couples in which one partner commutes for longer than 45 minutes are 40% more likely to divorce. So, if peak oil doesn't do the job and rising prices don't do the job, how about the need for matrimonial happiness? Might that do the job?
Well, I don't know about that. But talking about commuting together, I mean, I've got three sons, and being a working mother as well, one of the things that I tried to do to keep our family close and spending time together was to have them go to school near where I was working. So every morning we'd go into school and we'd recite the times table against, I mean, it's not politically incorrect to do so, but we'd recite the times table and go through arithmetic and do a bit of homework, mental arithmetic, on the way home. So I think that brought us together as a family and gave us more time to spend together as a family.
That sounds like a neat idea. Jeff, you're the hometown guy. You want to take the last 30 seconds? Wrap it up for us?
Sure. I think I want to go back to the issue about flying. And one of the things that is abundantly clear in Canada where we're missing the boat is on high-speed rail. And if you look at Toronto, we have 86 flights that leave Pearson Airport every day that goes fewer than 500 kilometers. Mm-hmm. So those 86 flights are consuming enormous amounts of energy that could be replaced with a much higher efficiency mode.
Exactly.
Our governments have been thus far unwilling to make meaningful investments in rail systems.
Mm-hmm. We thank all of our five guests for appearing on our program tonight. We wish you well with your work for the rest of this conference here at the Equinox Summit. We want to thank our audience for coming out tonight and joining us at the Perimeter Institute. Good of you to join us this evening for night two of our week-long series here at the Equinox Summit. And we would say that for more information on our guest tonight on this Equinox Summit and to read more about the Google car that we talked about earlier in the program, go to our website. It's all there, tvo.org/theagenda. We've also got lots online for you on our blogs. There are charts on renewable energy and the world's top CO2 emitters, and FYI, Canada's number one on the list, and it's not a good thing. We have past agenda discussions on the future of the car, and we have more videos from this Equinox Summit. I want to thank tonight's producers, Vodek Schemberg, Sandra Jonas, and Allison Buck-and-Terrell, and we ask you to stay with us for just a few moments because we've got some highlights about what's going to be coming up on tomorrow night's program, and we'll do that right after this.
Raising a baby on the streets can be a cryptic blessing. In a community plagued by drugs, poverty, and abandonment, silver linings don't seem obvious. Follow the intense personal journey of a street teen's venture into motherhood. What does it take to end a vicious circle of despair? See the amazing power love can have over the most extreme circumstances. Don't miss Children of the Park. Tomorrow at 9 on TVO.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
And that is the agenda for Tuesday, June the 7th, 2011. Tomorrow night, a closer look at how we can keep the buildings we live in and work in lit, warm, and efficient. That'll be part three of our special series here at the Equinox Summit in Waterloo. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org, and we say good night from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario.